Thank you so much. Yeah, thanks for inviting me to give this talk. It's a great opportunity, and it's super nice to be back to PI and see everyone again. So today I'm going to be talking about some work that I put out on the archive last month called Large N Vandermeer Algebras and the Renormalization of Newton's Constant. So let me start this talk by starting with something very standard in holography, which is the quantum extremal surface formula. So the quantum extremal surface formula is one of the cornerstones of holography, and what it does is that it expresses the entropy of a boundary state restricted to some boundary subregion as the sum of two terms, one of them being the area here of the quantum extremal surface, and the other one being the entropy of the bulk fields inside that quantum extremal surface. So the way you define this quantum extremal surface sigma is basically by looking at the right-hand side, you're looking at all the bulk regions that are homologous to the boundary region you're considering, and you're extremizing this right-hand side over all the possible choices. And then, in the case of a spacetime that has time reflection symmetry, you can show that actually this extremization is just a minimization. Otherwise, it's a bit more technical, but that's how you find which surface sigma should be. So for concreteness today, essentially because I don't want to have to deal with the fact that Ryutaq energy surfaces go all the way to infinity, I'm going to be mainly thinking about one case, which is the case of a two-sided black hole. So in the case of a two-sided black hole, QES reduces to the calculation of black hole entropy in the following way. So let's say this is a time slice of my ADS CFT correspondence. I have two disconnected boundary CFTs. And between them, I'm going to have an Einstein-Rosen bridge because I'm on a two-sided black hole. So this Einstein-Rosen bridge is going to be divided into two sides, one of them being the left side, the other side being the right side. And now what QES tells me is that if I take the state of the boundary restricted to the left, its entropy is going to be equal to the sum of two terms. The first term is the area of the quantum extremal surface, which in this case is basically the black hole horizon, over 4g Newton. And then the second term is the entropy of the bulk fields in the effective field theory that live on the left-hand side of this quantum extremal surface. So the starting point of this talk is that even though this quantum extremal surface formula is so fundamental, it is actually not so straightforward to properly define each of its terms. Especially if you take seriously the idea that, you know, this in the bulk we should really be thinking of the effective field theory description of the bulk. Well, the entropy as bulk of the quantum fields across the horizon should just be the entropy of the quantum fields across some subregion of quantum field theory. And from standard arguments in quantum field theory, we know that this is infinite. So it needs to be regulated. So the S bulk term of the QES formula is already not so easy to define because it needs to be regulated. And then we also have something funny happening about Newton's constant in this business. Namely, if you think about the bulk, you're really thinking about the effective field theory. And in that effective field theory, usually you want to think of taking G Newton to zero, or at least doing some perturbation theory in G Newton or in 1 over n by the holographic dictionary. But this is kind of weird because we're dividing by G Newton in the area term. So it looks like the area term goes up. And actually, while we're taking G Newton to zero or perturbation theory in 1 over n in the bulk, if you want to think about the boundary, this is really a UV finite quantity that you're calculating. You're calculating the entropy of the boundary state of a finite, very large, but finite n CFT. Okay, so on the boundary, if G Newton is taken to be zero, then the entropy would just blow up. So that's not what we're doing. G Newton needs to be taken small, or n needs to be taken very large, but non-zero. Okay, so there's also this funny business about G Newton when you think of the effective field theory, whereas where you think about the UV complete picture. Okay, so coming back to the first problem, which was the problem of the divergence of the fields across the horizon in the effective field theory description. Well, there seems to be an arbitrariness in the choice of UV cutoff that we make there, right? Depending on how we choose to regulate this entropy, we're going to have a different number that's going to be calculated. But this is very strange, because if you think about the QES formula, you know, the left-hand side of it calculates a UV complete quantity, which is just the UV complete entropy of the state at finite n on the boundary. But then in the right-hand side, you have the area term and the bulk entropy term, and now I'm saying that the bulk entropy term is dependent on the choice of cutoff. Whereas the left-hand side cannot depend on my choice of cutoff that I make in my effective field theory description, which is just a nice story I'm telling myself to understand the physics. So how is that possible that we have a formula that seems to depend on a cutoff on its right-hand side, but to be independent of the cutoff on the left-hand side. Well, fortunately for us, Susskind and Uglum made a conjecture a few decades ago now, actually even before holography was discovered. And what they noticed in that is that, I guess in modern language, in this QS formula, there's another free parameter. Namely, it's the G Newton that appears and divides the area term in the bulk. And the conjecture that they made is that, OK, maybe you have a dependence of the bulk entropy depending on which cutoff you choose. But you can also run the effective value of G Newton in the bulk depending on that choice of cutoff. And the conjecture is that even though the bulk entropy term has a value that depends on the cutoff, if it turns out that the renormalization of Newton's constant when you change the cutoff exactly cancels this change of value of the bulk entropy, then you end up with a UV finite quantity for the sum of the two quantities. Because even though both quantities are individually dependent on the cutoff, their renormalizations cancel each other out, and you end up with a boundary entropy that doesn't depend on your EFT cutoff. Okay, so there have been some heuristic arguments for this Susskind-Uglum conjecture, especially a lot of calculations have been made in the context of gravitational path integrals and so on. But it hasn't really been formalized in the recent developments about thinking of quantum error correction in ADS, CFT, and so on. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to try to convince you that the recent discussions on the large N limit of holography, as well as the framework of holographic quantum error correction, actually allow to formulate this conjecture more precisely and to prove it within this framework. So that's going to be the plan of the talk. So the way I'm going to do this is that first I'm going to briefly review some of the exciting new developments about the large N limit of holography. And then, so these large N von Neumann algebras are the algebras that describe the effective field theory that appears in the bulk in the large N limit. So the next step is going to be to understand how to regulate these algebras in order to isolate, some finite bulk entropy term that is going to be identified with the bulk entropy term in the QES formula. The second step is going to be to introduce a framework called code subspace renormalization, which basically tells you how to renormalize this bulk entropy term. And then at the end, I'm going to use this framework to prove this Susskind-Uglum conjecture that I made in the beginning. Any questions before I move forward? If not, let me start by mentioning large N von Neumann algebras. So I'm going to be starting this talk by explaining how these large N von Neumann algebras are defined, what they tell us, and why they're useful for this problem. So another more abstract way of saying that entanglement of bulk fields in the effective field theory diverges in the large N limit, just like the one of a QFT would, is that there is an emergent type 3-1 von Neumann algebra that appears in the large N limit of holography, as was recently identified by Lotoiso and Liu. So I'm going to come back to the definition, or at least some properties of this type 3-1 algebra later, but for now, let me just tell you briefly how it's constructed. What you do is that you first start by defining the Hilbert space that it acts on. So you start with a formal vacuum vector that you're going to declare is, the vacuum state of this wormhole. And you're going to define the Hilbert space that the algebra is going to act on by just being formally spanned by operators of the form like this. So products of single trace operators. And I should say that they're renormalized by their one-point function so that everything converges in the large N limit, but I didn't write it down for the sake of notation. And now the inner product of the Hilbert space is defined in the following way. So what we want to say is, OK, we have this formal vector space. Now we want to endow it with an inner product. So how do we do this? Well, if we take operators A and B of this form here, products of single traces, we're going to formally define the inner product of these two vectors, A omega and B omega, as being given by the large N limit of the correlation functions of these operators in the state of interest. So for example, if we're thinking of the thermofield double, it would just be the correlation functions at inverse temperature beta. OK, and that endows my Hilbert space with an inner product. So this is known in the math literature as the GNS construction. And now, OK, I'm saying something kind of strange, right? Because I'm saying these von Neumann algebras should know about the divergence of the entanglement and so on. But so far, all I have is this formal algebra of single trace operators that act on this Hilbert space that turns out to have divergent entanglement between the left and the right. But it looks like these single trace operators by themselves don't really know about the divergence of this entanglement. So how do I teach these single trace operators about the divergence of these entanglements? And well, it turns out that I do that by promoting them to a von Neumann algebra. So what do I mean by this? Well, I mean that the von Neumann algebra of single trace operators is defined as the bicommutant of the single trace operators on one side of, for example, thermofield double state. So what do I mean by bicommutant? Well, I mean, if you start with operators on the right-hand side of my thermofield double, what I do is I ask, who are all the operators on this Hilbert space that commute with the operators I started with? And so roughly speaking, the answer are going to be operators that live on the left. And then I ask the same question again, because it's bicommutant. So I ask, who commutes with everyone here? And I end up with, once again, operators that live on the right. But it turns out that along the way, because this operation has been performed on the precise Hilbert space, which is this GNS Hilbert space, the bicommutant is actually going to be a bit larger than my original algebra. And its precise structure is going to know about the entanglement pattern between the left and the right. Okay, so by taking this bicommutant operation, I teach my single trace operators about the underlying entanglement structure of the Hilbert space, which is why it's useful to do this operation. Okay, so I've been claiming that, you know, by doing this, you get an algebra that knows about the entanglement structure. So what do I mean by this? Well, first, what I mean is that below, you know, the von Neumann algebras come in types. So what type of von Neumann algebras do I get? Well, below the Hawking page temperature, the large n von Neumann algebra, so this algebra that I get by taking the bicommutant of these single trace operators in the large n limit, has type 1. So type 1 means something very simple. It just means that the large n Hilbert space actually does factorize between the left and the right. Okay, so if you look at this picture, you should be worried. That means, because that really looks like we have an effective field theory living on here, so it shouldn't factorize. So what happens is that below the Hawking page temperature, we actually don't have a wormhole. What we have is two entangled copies of thermal ADS. Okay, just entangled, but no geometric connection between the two, which is why we have a Hilbert space that does factorize between the left and the right. And then what happens is that above the Hawking page temperature, the gauge theory deconfines. And what that means is that now we have enough entanglement to create a geometric Einstein-Rosen bridge between the two sides. So that's translated in this von Neumann algebra language in the fact that the large N algebra now has type 3-1. I should emphasize that this type 3-1 is really a property of the large N limit. So if you were doing the calculation at any finite value of N, you would still have type 1. But in this large N limit, you get the emergence of this wormhole. And this is translated by the fact that you obtain a type 3-1 von Neumann algebra, which basically tells you that now you have an entanglement pattern that looks more like the one of a quantum field theory. Okay, and that's consistent with the fact that this algebra you should really think of as describing the effective field theory on one side of the wormhole. Okay, so a geometric Einstein-Rosen bridge appears between the right and the left. I should say that so far this discussion has been done at a heuristic level in the physics literature, but it's actually possible to make it very precise. So this can be shown rigorously. So I have a paper to appear with Leonardo Santilli where we show that essentially, if you know the spectral density of the large N generalized free fields, you can completely rigorously show this property of changes from type 1 to type 3-1. Okay, so from now on, I'm going to be thinking about the type 3-1 case because I want to think about the wormhole because that's where the QES formula appears.
I have a question. Yeah. Similar question to what I asked yesterday.
Yeah.
But, is there an actual way to show this transition at large N depending on the value of the temperature?
Yes. Yes, so what you do is that, well, if I had infinite computational power, I could do it for you. So if I can calculate the spectral density of the large N generalized free fields, then you can show that the change of type comes from the change of what the spectral density looks like.
Well, I mean, like a bulk analysis.
Oh, a bulk analysis. Well, yeah, I mean, I guess you have an exchange of dominance of saddles, right, between thermal ADS and the... and the black hole?
But that's the one-sided.
Yeah, so that's for the one, okay, I see, for the one-sided case. Yeah. Well, I guess, okay, then you would have to recrotate from the Euclidean signature to the Lorentzian signature. But the idea is that, yeah, you purify the black hole, so you end up with two-sided black hole. It has a Z2 symmetry because like, basically the idea is that when you do this thermofield double construction, you end up with a copy of your system. So you have a one-sided black hole, it becomes a two-sided black hole. I don't know if that answers.
Yeah, here.
Yeah, I mean, I agree that there's some subtleties about going to a Lorentzian signature. Yeah, I guess a comment I should make is that really the point of view here that I'm taking is more, I'm starting all from the CFT, and I want to see this emerge from the CFT. So I guess this von Neumann algebra language is more adapted to the case where you're thinking of the bulk in the semi-classical limit as being emergent from the CFT. But I agree, I mean, you can still show things from the gravitational pattern. Okay, so we have this type 3-1 algebra, which has divergent entanglement. Okay, so entanglement between the left and the right at large n becomes infinite, and you know, then it becomes complicated to talk about any finite quantity. So okay, so I said that we wanted to prove something like a QES formula. But in order to prove something like a QES formula, we know from 10 years of holography that the good way to do this is by thinking of holographic quantum error correction. Okay, usually the way that people prove things like QES is by thinking of holography as a quantum error correcting code. So we want to think of a way to map this large N theory that is identified with these generalized free fields in the bulk that correspond to my effective field theory of what happens in the semi-classical limit into the UV complete picture. And that should be a quantum error correcting code. But it turns out that it is a bit tricky to think about holographic quantum error correction in that context. So let me explain why. If we take this idea that really the code subspace of the quantum error correcting code should correspond to the semi-classical theory and it should be mapped to the UV complete picture, well, we end up with the fact that, you know, in the bulk we should take an n equals infinity theory, which is this effective field theory that we get in the large n limit, or maybe some perturbation in 1 over n, but nothing non-perturbative, which has type 3-1, right? So this is this large n von Neumann algebra of type 3-1 that I was talking about. And now our code should somehow map this effective field theory into a finite n theory, which is the UV complete description. So it should map it into something that now has type 1, so it's just the bounded operators on the left Hilbert space at finite n. Okay, so here we take n very large, but we still take it finite. But now this is very strange, right? Because even if n is very large, it's still much smaller than infinity. So what I mean by that is that if I start hitting my effective field theory really hard with operators that have an energy that's scaled parametrically with this actual finite value of n that I have on the boundary, well, I should no longer trust the bulk effective field theory description. It should break down. There should be some breakdown of spacetime, maybe some back reaction, maybe some quantum gravity effects that kick in. So this code is kind of weird, because for each finite value of n on the boundary, you know, I can always hit my effective field theory hard enough so that the code breaks down spectacularly. So how do I make sense of such a strange code? Well, the idea is that one shouldn't trust the code, the encoding map from the bulk to the boundary, when operators have energy that starts scaling parametrically with n and break the EFT. Another way to say this is that the code works pointwise but not uniformly. What I mean by this is the following. If I choose one point, so if I choose one operator, and I act on the effective field theory with it, I can always find an n on the boundary for UV complete theory that is large enough that the correlations of that operator are going to be a good approximation to what happens on the boundary theory. But then the opposite is not true. If I fix n on the boundary, I can always find operators in the effective field theory that are completely going to break the code. Okay, so that's what I mean by the fact that the code works pointwise at large n, but not uniformly. Okay, so how do I make sense of such a strange code that works pointwise at large n, but not uniformly? Well, fortunately for us, Tom Faulkner and Min Lee came out recently with a very nice paper in which they formalized this idea by introducing a notion called the notion of asymptotically isometric code, which basically takes this philosophy seriously. So it takes the n equals infinity theory to the finite n theory, and it works only pointwise, but not uniformly. So then they still have an encoding map, Vn, which gets close to an isometry, and for which you have good reconstruction properties. So here, these gamma n maps would be the reconstruction maps from the bulk to the boundary. But the crucial point is that they ask for these Vn convergences and for these gamma n convergences to not work uniformly with respect to that theory, but just pointwise. Okay, so these conditions are imposed for some things called the weak and strong operator topologies in the Hilbert spaces, respectively, but not for the norm topology. So this is just a more mathematical way of saying what I just said, which is that they only require pointwise convergence rather than uniform convergence. Okay, so these asymptotically isometric codes have some really nice successes. Like, for example, you get asymptotic conservation of modular flow, also known as the JLMS formula in the holography literature, which is a really important result in this pointwise sense. But what I want to argue for here is that you cannot really get away with using such a weird notion of code if you want to derive something like QES. What I mean more precisely is that if you want to derive something like QES, it is not right to think of the whole effective field theory that appears at large n as your code subspace, precisely because of these reasons that things are going to break down when you map it to finite n theory. The most straightforward reason for this is just what we said in the beginning, which is that because of the type 3-1 nature of this algebra that appears, the entanglement between the left and the right diverges in the effective field theory, so it needs to be regulated. But also the fact that the code, if you fix n on the boundary, starts breaking down for a lot of observables that have too high energy is also, you know, a good reason why this must be regulated. Okay, so now the question is, well, how do we do this regulation of this large n von Neumann algebra in a way that I can still talk about holographic quantum error correction, because that's how I want to prove the QES formula in the Susskind-Englund conjecture. So how do I regulate this large n von Neumann algebra to get a finite bulk entropy term so that I can talk about QES? Well, the answer that I would like to advocate for is that what I'm going to do is that instead of looking at this whole large n algebra, I'm going to be singling out some small, for example, finite dimensional subalgebras of this large n algebra. And then what I'm going to do is that I'm going to be asking for stronger reconstruction properties than just these pointwise versions of reconstruction, but just for these smaller algebras. OK. Before I move on to how I actually find these smaller algebras and make sure that their structure is compatible with holographic reconstruction, are there any questions at this stage? OK. If not, let me carry on. So the goal of this section that I called code subspace renormalization is to do this. So it's to look at this large n algebra, m left, and to single out some small algebras for which I'm going to be able to talk about good uniform reconstruction properties. And those are going to be identified with my regulation of the bulk entropy term. So what do I want? Well, first, I want to ask, what does a good regulated subalgebra look like? And here, you know, an essential criterion is that we want this regulated algebra to match the bulk entropy term of the QES formula in the large n limit. So in particular, we want it to be finite, the entropy associated to this algebra. And well, here we're lucky because there's a theorem in von Neumann algebras that basically tells you that if you want to have a finite entropy, this algebra must have type 1, i.e. it must factorize with the rest of the system. There cannot be like a divergent amount of entanglement that spoils factorization. So type 1 algebras are very simple. They're either finite dimensional or bounded operators on a separable Hilbert space, or at least type 1 factors, I should say. And then, OK, so if we want an algebra that has finite entropy so that it's type 1, well, it turns out that in that case, you know, it's really nice because you can define Schmidt decompositions for states on these algebras, and you can just think of von Neumann entropy in the way you usually think. So nothing, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about these large n algebras having some weird traces for which you have to rescale the entropy and so on. Nothing happens here. For this regulated subalgebra, the entropy is just the entropy that everyone is used to. And you can just use some very standard quantum information techniques to study entropy on these finite dimensional algebras. OK. So we've made one piece of progress, which is these regulated algebras, we want them to be type 1. We want them to have finite entropy. So that was the easy part. But now there's also something else that we need to ask for.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Just clarifying. This is a subalgebra of ML or?
Of ML, yes. So you have the n equals infinity algebra,
okay,
which has divergent entanglement. So now you need to regulate it. And the way to regulate it is to look at just a subalgebra of nice observables
right
inside it.
And the key is that you want to make sure that the subalgebra is kind of big enough and not just like some.
Well, actually, I want to make sure that it's small enough. That it has finite entropy. Okay, I agree that there is an amount of arbitrariness in how I choose it. I could choose one, I could choose a slightly bigger one. And that's going to be an important point, actually. Yeah.
I guess I lost track of your nomenclature. When you say the bulk entropy term,
yes,
you mean that formula A over 4G plus?
Plus S bulk. Yeah, that's what I mean by bulk entropy term. Yeah.
And when you say match, you just mean you want a finite answer.
Yeah, I just want to find a number that is not infinity.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So and the way I do this is by taking this divergent algebra that has like too much entanglement and just looking at a small part of it. Okay. So now, okay, we have this algebra, but we need to worry about more things. Namely, you know, if we want to prove something like a QES formula, we know that the way to do it is by thinking of holographic quantum error correction. And there's a technical word for this, which is entanglement wedge reconstruction. So the property of entanglement wedge reconstruction is thought to be equivalent to the QES formula. And what it is a statement of complementary recovery. Okay, so what entanglement wedge reconstruction tells you is that, for example, let's take the case of the two-sided black hole. What it tells you is that any operator in the effective field theory that lives on the left, I can reconstruct on the left CFT. And any operator in the effective field theory that lives on the right, I can reconstruct on the right CFT. Okay, so complementary recovery, because these two algebras are commutants of each other. And so I'm saying that any element on this algebra I can reconstruct there, and any element of the commutant I can reconstruct on the commutant. Okay, so that's why it's a statement of complementary recovery. And actually, you can show that this statement of complementary recovery can be proven in the same pointwise sense as I was describing before for these asymptotically isometric codes that were introduced by Faulkner and Lee. So now the question is, you know, whatever regulation we do to the Lagrangian Hilbert space in the Lagrangian algebras, it should be compatible with this notion of complementary recovery. It should preserve this commutant structure. Okay, so how do we do this? How do we regulate the algebra in a way that still makes it possible to talk about complementary recovery? Well, we want compatibility with it. So that's the next point that I'm going to go towards. So that induces some constraints. So we want to find a way to regulate the Lagrangian algebra that respects this fundamental structure of complementary recovery. So what we want more formally is something that looks like this. We have the Lagrangian algebra, which is the unregulated thing that we want to regulate that lives on the right, that acts on this Lagrangian Hilbert space H. And we know that its commutant is given by this right algebra here. Okay? And now what we want is to find a regulated Hilbert space subspace of the Lagrangian Hilbert space, H lambda, and the regulated algebra that looks in, that sits inside this big algebra, such that, you know, the commutant structure is compatible. So I want to say that if I take the commutant of the subalgebra inside this small Hilbert space, I get something that lives inside the big algebra and not something else, so that I can still talk about what's on the right and what's on the left. And it turns out that this is a non-trivial constraint. So the question is, you know, what should these question marks be? What should these maps that project you from the big algebra into the smaller algebra be in order to preserve this commutant structure when I do my renormalization? Well, fortunately for us, it turns out that mathematicians solved the problem about 60 years ago, so we're just a bit late. The following statements are equivalent. The first one is this commutant structure preservation that I talked about with this commutative diagram. The second one is the conservation of modular flow. So if you don't know a lot about Tomita Takasaki theory and modular flow, you can just ignore this one. But basically, the idea is that if you take any state in the regulated Hilbert space, H lambda, you want to say that the modular flow associated to this state is preserved under projection. Okay, so that's what this statement says. And the last statement, which is the statement that we are actually going to care about today, is the following. It is that there exists a faithful, normal, conditional expectation from the Lagrangian algebra onto the subalgebra that leaves the state invariant. Okay, so that's a lot to unpack, so we're going to unpack it slowly. But let me just say that the crucial point is going to be that this question mark map that I was asking what it was before, it's what it should be, has an answer in mathematics, and it's called a conditional expectation. You can ignore these adjectives to first order. So next, the question is, well, we're assuming that conditional expectations solve the problem. So what is a conditional expectation? Well, there is the non-helpful way of saying it, which is the formal definition. So conditional expectation from a von Neumann algebra, so we're thinking of this big unregulated algebra, into the regulated subalgebra, is a projection map that satisfies this axiom. OK, so far it doesn't tell us much. But the crucial point is that Takasaki's theorem tells us that if a state is in the Hilbert space of invariant states under conditional expectations, so in this regulated Hilbert space, then this very deep theorem in operator algebras tells us that it's Tomita Takasaki modular data associated to the unregulated and the regulated algebra coincide. So if you don't know what these Tomita Takasaki data are, you don't need to know a lot about them. You just need to know that there are two operators One of them is this delta here. And what it does is that it carries information about modular flow. And the other one is this J here. And this one is the one of interest because it's the one that carries information about the commutant structure. OK, so what this tells us, what this Takizaki theorem tells us, is that if I have a map that maps my big algebra onto my small algebra that satisfies this axiom, then any state that is invariant under this map actually is compatible with commutation, with complementary recovery. OK, so the answer we want is that we want subalgebras of type 1 of our algebra, but we also want conditional expectations to project onto them. And we want to look at regulated Hilbert spaces of invariant states under these conditional expectations. And if we have that, then we have conservation of, we have compatibility with complementary recovery. OK, so from there, the characterizations in terms of modular flow and commutant flow. OK, so let's recapitulate. What we have so far is that we want type 1 algebras. We want conditional expectations onto them. And we want them to act on some regulated Hilbert spaces. So type 1, conditional expectation. Well, what does a conditional expectation onto a type 1 algebra look like? And here we're lucky, because it turns out that even though conditional expectations can get a bit messy in general operator theory, when it's onto a type 1 algebra, it's actually possible to write them down very explicitly. So hopefully, this slide is going to clarify some of the mysticism around this notion of conditional expectation. And it's going to show you that it does something very simple and very physical to the theory. So in the case of a type 1 subfactor, conditional expectations allow basically to factor everything out as a tensor product of low and high energy contributions. So by low and high energy, I just mean whatever is kept when we cut off the theory and whatever is thrown away. So more precisely, we have this large n factor, m left, which is divergent, and acts on this large n Hilbert space H. Well, now, if we take a regulated subfactor, so regulated ML lambda inside this big algebra, then the first thing is that because it's type 1, I can actually factor everything out. So I can say the big algebra is the tensor product of the low energy contributions and whatever I want to throw out. And then if we take a conditional expectation that goes from this big algebra onto the regulated algebra, then you can show that the Hilbert space factorizes also into a low energy part and a high energy part. Okay, and the low energy part corresponds to the Hilbert space of invariant states under the expectation, which is exactly the Hilbert space that we wanted in order to preserve complementary recovery. And it is of this form. So in the low energy part, it can be any state I want. But then it's frozen in a reference state for the high energy part. And then the idea is that this reference state is basically the datum of the conditional expectation. So what the conditional expectation does for you is that if you feed it an operator that has a part that I want to keep and a part that I want to throw away, then it eats the part that I want to throw away by taking the expectation value of this part under chi, and just leaves me with the low energy piece of the operator that I want to keep. OK, so this is a completely explicit formula that tells you what a conditional expectation actually does. What it does is that it throws away whatever I want to renormalize away, and it just leaves me with the low energy part. So from there, you can see that it's very natural to think that there is a map like this from the big algebra onto the regulated subalgebra, just because it does exactly what we want. It eats away the high energy part, and it leaves you with the low energy part. OK, good. So now we have everything we need to define the main notion of this section, which is the notion of code subspace renormalization scheme. OK, so this is the notion I'm going to use to renormalize this code subspace, to renormalize this large N algebra in a way that allows me to retain both finite entropy and information about complementary recovery so that I can prove QES later on. So code subspace renormalization scheme is the given data of the following. First, a von Neumann factor, M left, that acts on the Hilbert space H. OK, so this is the unregulated algebra, the unregulated Hilbert space at large N. Doesn't factorize. And then what we're going to take is a family of type 1 subfactors, which are these regulated algebras that we want to consider. And we're going to index them by some partially ordered set of energy scales. OK, so let's just write two of them. So we would have m lambda left. And let's say we have a smaller energy scale, m mu. And then we have the idea is that we're going to have conditional expectations that go from the unregulated part to the regulated part. So we're going to have a projection here, e lambda. We're going to have another projection here, e mu. And then we also want to be able to relate these two different energy scales. So I'm also going to assume some conditional expectations there. Okay. And then the next thing that I want is I want to have a reference cyclic separating state that is invariant under these expectations. So ignore cyclic separating. I just want a reference state, which is basically going to be the vacuum state of my sector. Okay, and I want it to be invariant under all of these expectations so that it's inside all the regularized code subspaces. And then the idea is that from this state, I can construct my regularized Hilbert spaces. So I start with this reference state, omega. And then I act on it with, say, mu left. And that gives me the regulated Hilbert space h mu. And then I do the same. So I have like successive projections like this. So h lambda would be just m lambda left times omega. And then I would have successive projections. And now the punchline is that by the fact that we check that these things are invariant under the conditional expectations and so on, we can make sure that everything is compatible with the commutant structure. So if I have the right algebra, which is just the commutant of the left algebra, then you know I'm also going to have projections like this. And I'm going to make sure that everything is compatible with the commutant structure. So if I take the commutant on the smaller Hilbert space, I end up with something that does live inside the complementary algebra on the unregulated scheme. So everything here is compatible with the commutant structure, which is good because now we can still talk about complementary recovery for these smaller algebras. OK, so we did all of this in order to be able to isolate a finite bulk entropy term for these regulated algebras. Now the next thing that I want to do is to explain how to express entropy in such a context, because that's what we're going to need in order to identify the bulk entropy term. So if we look at, let's say,
Before you go there, you started by talking about big and small algebras, and then suddenly it became high and low energies.
Yeah, sorry, I'm using this term very loosely. I shouldn't. Yeah, you could just think.
I thought you were going to. The question was going to be, does your approach somehow tell me that there's a unique way to regulate?
So
in field theory, I can pick lots of different ways.
Yes, so.
Don't see that.
I think there should be lots of different ways there too.
Oh.
Actually, that's going to be part of the point.
Okay. I don't mean just changing the energy scale.
So that's an open.
Dimensional regularization versus polyvalar. Mm-hmm. There's all sorts of different tricks people use.
Right.
Somehow all work out.
So here, I'm planning to go back to this a bit at the end, but basically the idea is I don't think I'm yet in a situation where you can hand me a field theory and I can construct these things entirely explicitly from like some renormalization scheme for you. That's something I'm working towards, but I don't think I'm there yet.
Okay.
That being said, I think whatever should work should at least approximately look like this.
Yeah.
Because this is something that we need in order to have error correction. So at this stage, the honest answer is this is what I have. I really think this should look like something we should aim for an explicit regularization procedure. What I don't have is the details of that explicit regularization procedure. Okay. So,
can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure.
I was curious, so you have this condition that the commutant is compatible with your down arrows.
Yep.
Is that like necessary, or is that a scheme choice that just is convenient for proving what you're going to prove?
I would say the latter. Yeah, the point is that this commutant structure is very important if you want to think about integument wedge reconstruction, because it's all about the commutant. Like integument wedge reconstruction tells you I can reconstruct one part on one part and the commutant on the commutant. So if you lose the commutant along the way, well, it's more complicated. So you should have a way to say that at least approximately you have something like this that holds.
Would there be a problem with crossing the arrows, for example, if you were to match like MR to M left?
Yeah, so that would be the problem, right? Like, I could imagine a situation in which this M left, when I take the commutant on the regulated Hilbert space, doesn't land inside MR. And then it's messy because I'm not expecting to reconstruct these observables on the other side. So that's why I want to impose this compatibility. Yeah. Okay, any other question? Okay, if not, maybe I can carry on with expressing entropies in this code subspace renormalization scheme. So consider two renormalized algebras, M lambda and M mu, okay, with lambda bigger than mu. And the idea is that M lambda is the tensor product of the lower energy part, so this M mu, and then M lambda mu, which is whatever sits in M lambda but not in M mu. And that's because they're all type 1, so we can factorize things very easily. So as it is invariant under the conditional expectations, then we know from before that we can factor out also the state, any state actually in this lowest regulated Hilbert space, into three pieces. The first piece is basically anything we want, because that's the low energy or smallest degrees of freedom we want to keep. And then everything else we have to freeze, because we said that this is a regulated Hilbert space. So we freeze this middle part, and we freeze this high part into some reference states that dictate which conditional expectation I'm looking at, which are these chi lambda mu and this chi lambda. OK, and then just by factorization, you know, you can just think of the entropy associated to the left as the sum of three pieces, right? You have the entropy of the whole state, which we said is divergent, which is why I put it in quotation marks, which is the sum of the entropy of the lowest energy piece, the entropy of whatever is in the higher energy of whatever is in the higher cutoff but not in the lower cutoff, which is this middle piece here, and then the entropy of the rest, which is the divergent piece that we want to throw away anyway, regardless of whether we choose lambda or mu. Okay, so this is good because then we really get the contributions of the different scales in that entropy formula. Without giving too much away, I should say that it is really this middle term here, S of chi lambda mu, that is going to be crucial in the proof of the Saskia-Naglom conjecture. Okay, so I'm going to move on to the proof of that conjecture, but before doing so, I just wanted to make a quick comment that's sort of an aside about the fact that it's not the first time that these conditional expectations show up in holography. So maybe this is more of a historical point, but I think there are some interesting lessons to learn from that. So a few years ago, Faulkner made the observation that this structure of conditional expectation underpins the structure of exact integument wedge reconstruction. So if the holographic map and the reconstruction of the EFT was an exact code and there were no errors in it, then really it would be a conditional expectation. That's what Faulkner showed. More precisely, he said that the holographic map is identified with this conditional expectation. So whatever projects you onto the code subspace is this conditional expectation. And then the statements that we always make about holographic codes, which are complementary recovery and this JLMS formula, which is the conservation of modular flow, stems from the conservation of these Tomita Takizaki data that is described in this Takizaki theorem. But here, you know, the interpretation we make of these conditional expectations in this case is slightly different, because we say that they integrate out some high energy degrees of freedom in the EFT, and they just leave us with whatever regularized algebra we want. But the point I want to make is that both perspectives are related. Namely, one can see this regulation as an exact code that maps the subalgebra, which is the algebra of regulated observables, inside the big algebra. Okay? So another way of seeing this regularization, renormalization structure is to think of the algebra that I end up with, the regulated one, as just a code subalgebra of the unregulated one. And that's what this result of Faulkner tells us. And in hindsight, it sort of makes sense that this exact structure remains in the large N limit. Because it was shown a couple years ago by Hayden, Pennington, and others that the real obstructions, like the ones that I can't get rid of, to exactness of reconstruction in holography come from non-perturbative corrections in 1 over N. Okay, that was shown. Basically, everything that is perturbative, you can sort of deal with at the level of the effective field theory, and you're left with something that is non-perturbative in 1 over N. But now these errors that are non-perturbative in 1 over N are exactly the ones that disappear when I look at this large N algebra. Because this large N algebra, by construction, can only contain either the strict N equals infinity limit or maybe some 1 over N perturbation of it, but no non-perturbative corrections. So it sort of makes sense that when I think about this large N algebra, I get a remnant of this structure of exact holographic quantum error correction, because now I ignore all the non-perturbative errors. Okay, so this was more of an aside, but I think it sort of shows the consistency between this picture and what have been said before. Okay, So that being said, this was not strictly necessary for the proof. So all I'm going to use is basically the structure of this code subspace renormalization scheme. So I'm now ready to prove the conjecture. So is there any question before I move on there?
Just a small thing. So normally, if you have a conditional expectation, right, between two monomer algebras, you would be able to define something like the Jones index. Does it tell us anything in holography?
Good. Okay. So the Jones index. So here it's a bit boring, because you have a conditional expectation from something infinite into something finite, right? I'm going to think of these type 1 algebras as being finite dimensional most of the time. So Jones index would be infinite, so it's not very interesting. The Jones index usually is more interesting when you think of inclusions of type 2 factors. So like if you have a type 2 1 factor, which is very divergent, and another one which is also very divergent, then you can sort of ask, like, how many copies of the type 2 factor do I have inside the bigger one? Here, I have infinitely many, so it's a bit boring. So that's why I would expect that, you know, in holography, at least in this context, the Jones index is always infinite. But it's not impossible that in some other contexts, in quantum gravity, the Jones index would be useful. So,
sure.
Yeah.
There was this high energy state, chi lambda.
Mm-hmm.
Was that, like, can you, what, how did you pick that?
Yeah, so, okay, good. So, in the
high, if you told me.
Oh, no, I didn't. So in the high energy, so this chi lambda you can think of as, think of this chi or this omega in general as being your background. And the chi lambda is whatever your background looks like at very high energies. And so what I'm saying is that I can only sort of middle with the low energy degrees of freedom with my regulated algebra, but I keep the high energy ones fixed. Which is why I freeze the state in chi lambda in my regulated Hilbert space.
But you got to pick that in an arbitrary way, or like?
Well, I guess it depends which background I'm looking at, right?
Okay.
So yeah, so there is a catch, which is.
So the background's gonna. Well, I should let you finish. Go ahead.
Oh no, I think I'm mostly done. Yeah.
Is the background gonna tell me what chi lambda is? Or?
Yeah, that would be the idea.
Okay.
Yeah, the chi lambda basically corresponds to what your GNS state is in the regime where you're in the high energy.
Okay.
So you have your GNS state. You assume that it factorizes well in terms of your choices of energy. And then you say, I can do whatever I want to the low energy part, but I fix the high energy part into whatever the background is. Okay. So any other question? Okay, if not, I can move on to the proof of this Susskind-Englund conjecture. So now we have a consistent way of renormalizing the code subspace. Okay, thanks to this, we have a nice way that preserves commutant structures and so on, so that I can talk about complementary recovery and make a good complementary recovery hypothesis from which I can prove the QES formula. So now, you know, all of this was done to deal with the large N algebra, but what we want to do in the end is map it into the finite N theory. So that's what I'm going to do now, and recall that there exists an encoding map from the theory at n equals infinity to the finite n theory, we said, which was this Vn that goes from the large n Hilbert space into, you know, the finite n Hilbert space. And the crucial point, as we said, was that closeness to isometry and good reconstruction properties for this map can only be formulated pointwise. And so the idea here is to ask for stronger reconstruction properties, but only for these small renormalized subalgebras. Okay, so how do we do this more formally? Well, we look at a smaller code, basically. So we consider one of these renormalized Hilbert spaces of my code subspace renormalization scheme, so this H lambda, for example. And so we know that we have a von Neumann factor acting on it, this N lambda. And you know, to simplify, we're going to assume that everything regulated is finite dimensional of dimension independent of N. Okay, so for now, I fix its dimension regardless of what the value of n is on the boundary. So then, because everything's finite dimensional, you know, there's no obstruction to factorization of the Hilbert space or whatever, so I can just factorize my Hilbert space as a left piece and a right piece. And then the idea is that the regulated observables at energy lambda that live on the left are just the bounded operators on the left piece. So then what I'm going to do is just, I'm going to say, well, you know, I have this regulated subspace that lives inside my unregulated space, and then I have my map Vn that sends my unregulated space to the finite n theory. So my code is just going to be, well, first I embed this regulated space into the big space, and then I map it through VM. Okay, so this new code, this smaller code, is literally just the restriction of the old code to the small Hilbert space. So that's the code. It is for this restriction of the map that we are going to ask uniform reconstruction properties instead of pointwise now.
Why are there squiggles in the middle?
Squiggles?
You didn't write equals.
Oh, isomorphic. Yeah. Okay. That's pedantic mathematical notation. Sorry. equal. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So now we're almost ready. Okay. We have our code restricted to the small space. But, you know, everything I've been saying so far is about the bulk entropy term. But in the QES formula on the right hand side, you have two terms. You have the bulk entropy term and you have the area term. And I haven't talked about the area term yet, but it should play a role. So let me now define what I mean by area term, and then I'll be ready to state the theorem. So essentially for this, there's been some really nice work done by first Harlow in the exact case, and then Akers and Pennington in the approximate case. And I'm going to follow their approach. So consider the map Vn that goes from this regulated Hilbert space into the large n Hilbert space. Oh, sorry, into the finite n Hilbert space. The idea is that we're going to define the area term through the entropy of a state called the Choi-Jia-Mielkowski state, which is defined by this formula. So this is a bit of a lot to unpack, so let me just explain what this Choi-Jia-Mielkowski is on this picture, and hopefully it's going to be a bit more clear why we're doing this. So now we're looking at the regulated algebras, so we add lambdas here. And the Choi-Jia-Mielkowski state is going to be constructed in the following manner. We start with the left and the right algebras, which are regulated, and we maximally entangle them with some reference systems, L and R. Okay? So that's this first step. And then what we do is we just use the bulk-to-boundary map to map this to the boundary. So that's what the Choi-Jia-Mielkowski state does. Why is this a good choice for defining an area term? Well, it is because, you know, by entangling the degrees of freedom on the left and the right here, I make everything too busy being entangled maximally with another system to be able to be entangled with each other. So in that state, in the bulk, there is no, well, at least at the level of the renormalized Hilbert space, there is no entanglement between the left and the right. So then, you know, if I have a state that I map, and then I know that its entropy is equal to the area term plus the bulk entropy contribution, and in that state I have no bulk entropy contribution, well, it makes sense to define the area term as being the entropy of that state. Okay, so that's the idea, is that I'm going to define the entropy, sorry, the area term of my code as being the entropy of the Choi-Jia-Mielkowski state of the regulated Hilbert space. Okay, so this is this formula. The area associated to the left Hilbert space is just equal to the entropy of the Choi-Jia-Mielkowski state restricted to the left. Okay, so that's what I mean by an area term in the holographic code. Let me make an important point, because this is sort of going to be the most important point. There is only one value of area per code subspace, right? Because if I take my H lambda, well, there's just one definition of this Choi-Jia-Mielkowski state, so I just have one area term. And so that sort of makes sense if we want to think of this small code subspace as small fluctuations that propagate on a fixed background. I don't get to change my background, so the area stays constant. But what is going to be very important is that this value of the area changes depending on how I choose my regulation. So if I change the value of lambda to mu, for example, then I'm going to have less entangled degrees of freedom here in the code. So I'm going to keep more entanglement between the two sides, and the entropy of the Choi-Jia-Mielkowski state is going to go up. So even though for each choice of regulation there's only one value of the entropy of the Choi-Jia-Mielkowski state, this area term actually changes value depending on the scale I choose here. Okay, this is going to be one of the crucial points of the proof, so that's why I wanted to emphasize it. Okay, good. We finally have all the ingredients, so I can state the approximate Ryu-Takanagi or QES formula. So following Akers and Pennington, you can basically derive the following result. So basically, you ask for a really good reconstruction assumption just restricted to this regulated Hilbert space. So you ask that any operator, any unitary operator that acts on the left or the right in the regulated Hilbert space can be reconstructed really well on the boundary in a uniform way now, because I get to do that because I'm restricting to the regulated Hilbert space. And I'm going to ask that essentially the reconstruction error is non-perturbative in 1 over n. So I'm going to ask that I've taken care of all the perturbation theory directly at the level of the large n algebra so that I just have non-perturbative errors. And then the result is that if you ask this, you get this following formula. So in the large n limits, you get equality between the sum of the bulk entropy and the area term and the entropy of the boundary state. Okay, so this is a Ryutaku energy formula or a QES formula. It equates the entropy of the boundary state to the sum of the area term and the bulk entropy associated to the regulated Hilbert space. Okay, so good. We have a Ryutaku energy formula. But now, you know, this is not very new. Like, this type of result has already been proven in the past. Now what is really new is that we want to mix this formula with this framework of code subspace renormalization. And you know, in particular, this formula is true for lambda, but there's nothing special about this choice of lambda. If I had made another choice of lambda, this formula would still be true. Okay, so in particular, the crucial point is that this formula is valid for any choice of cutoff lambda, as long as, say, it doesn't depend on n so that it don't have extra complications. So in particular, if I take a state in the most regulated Hilbert space H mu, then I get both formulas. I get both that the entropy of the state associated to mu plus the area associated to mu is equal to the entropy of the boundary state. But I also get the same the entropy formula, but now by seeing my state as an element of H lambda, which contains H mu. Okay, so I have these two formulas. So now what I do is that I recall that, okay, I know that this M lambda here is just the tensor product of M mu and of whatever is not in M mu but it still is M lambda, but is still in M lambda. And I know from the properties of this code subspace renormalization scheme that the entropy is going to nicely factor out into two pieces, one of them that corresponds to the entropy of mu, and the other one, which I said was this important middle term that corresponds to the entropy of whatever is in m lambda, but not in mu. OK, so now I have this formula. I just re-inject it into this second equation here, do a bit of algebraic manipulations. And essentially, because this term is the same on both sides, I end up with this equation, which tells me that the area term associated to the mu energy scale in the large n limit goes to the sum of the area term associated to the lambda energy scale and the entropy of whatever is in the code subspace for lambda but not for mu. But this is exactly what we said in the beginning about this Suskind-Naglom conjecture, right? Which says that when I change the cutoff, I get this extra piece of entropy that now contributes to my bulk entropy term. But this contribution is thrown away into the renormalization of the area term. OK, so this is a proof of this fact coming purely from the structure of holographic quantum error correcting codes. But actually, I would like to argue that this is a bit more than a proof in the sense that it also provides a reinterpretation of this fact by Suskind and Naglom. Namely, if you think about it, what makes this fact work? Well, what really makes it work is that the bigger the code subspace, the smaller the entropy of the Choi-Jamnolkowski state is going to be, right? Because I disentangle more and more modes, and so I have less and less entanglement on the boundary. But there's nothing mystical about this. It's just because the missing entropy is now being counted as being part of the code subspace entropy. It's just that the entropy that I counted before as being part of the Choi-Jamnolkowski state, now I say is part of my bigger code subspace. So now it's reinterpreted as some code subspace entropy. So what this is saying is that there is some entropy in the code that can be counted either as bulk entropy or as geometry. And whether I count it as one or the other has nothing physical. It's just about the choice that I make, of nice story that I tell myself, that there is a regularization scale. But this regularization scale has nothing physical. So whether it is bulk entropy or geometry just amounts to making a choice of renormalization scale, which is completely unphysical. But now this is exactly the statement of ER equals EPR, right? Which is that in gravity, there should be no clear distinction between entanglement and emergent geometry. So this proof also shows that on a conceptual level, Suskind-Naglom is just an instance of the CR equals EPR paradigm. Okay, so I'm mostly done. I just want to end up with maybe some more technical comments for people who care about this topic. So far we assume that the dimension of the renormalized code subspace was fixed with n. Right, but actually, it turns out that you know the calculations of the page curve and things like that require the code subspace to scale with n, It's not a fixed dimension. It's a dimension that increases when n increases. But however, the Akers-Pennington technology also allows to handle cases in which this dimension varies with n. So that's kind of nice that this technology that they came up with is, you know, strong enough to also deal with these cases. So if the dimension grows sub-exponentially, then essentially you can lift all previous assumptions to that case. But then if it grows exponentially, you know, you have all these problems that come with entanglement wedge reconstruction, like the entanglement wedge becomes state dependent. You can even have this map Vn that can stop being even approximately isometric. You have all these problems. But basically, this unitary reconstruction assumption that I was making becomes too strong. But if instead you ask for a modified unitary reconstruction assumption, which is something called reconstruction of product unitaries that they came up with, then essentially everything goes through. So the nice thing is that because the core of the proof was really this Akers-Pennington technology, and that it is adaptable to also larger code subspaces, well, essentially this whole paradigm also applies to larger code subspaces. Let me just finish by mentioning a few future directions. So the first one is, as Rob was saying, this is still a proof in principle. You know, I'm still like assuming that I have these nice factorizations and so on. But now the question is, you know, can one actually start with an explicit large N theory and construct such a structure like this, or at least something that approximately looks like a structure like this? And the first step to do this seems to be to embed this framework into the construction of Faulkner and Lee, because they actually, like in their asymptotically isometric codes, come very close to doing that. A related question is, what about code subspaces that are not invariant under a conditional expectation? So for example, if they're only, you know, approximately invariant under this conditional expectation, can I still make an approximate QES formula? This would be relevant, for example, for cases in which it could be difficult to construct a conditional expectation that exactly leaves everything invariant. And then, of course, there's a question of understanding the case of large codes better. I also wanted to close by making this comment that so the fact that this QES formula is an instance of ER equals EPR because of this renormalization thing is actually reminiscent of another conjecture in quantum gravity. Namely, so there's a Swampland program that, you know, has a lot of general principles that should apply to UV complete theories of quantum gravity. And one of them is this Swampland emergence proposal that tells you that if you were to manage to renormalize the energy scale in the bulk all the way up to the UV scale, then all the kinetic terms in your quantum gravity should vanish. So in particular, this sort of general, you know, framework here would be interpreted as the fact that if I take lambda all the way to the UV scale, then the area term should vanish because everything should become code subspace entropy. So it's kind of nice to see that this seems to be sort of the same as this emergence proposal, and it would be nice to understand this better. Okay, I think I'm done for today. Thank you for listening, and I'll take questions.
Very nice talk, by the way. So I have two naive questions. So the first one is the CJ state. So
yes.
The way you wrote the formula is a vector state, right? Rather than the usual just take the toy matrix of that thing, right? So when you compute the entropy, do you mean that you take the CJ state and then trace all the second copy? Or?
That's exactly what I mean, yes.
Okay, so this CJ state is more like the factorization of the usual toy matrix? Or
well, you know, it's exactly the same as saying I have the left and the right. And I have a state which, you know, is on the composite system. As an overall state, it's a pure state, so it's a vector state. But if I restrict it to the left, it becomes a density matrix. So this is what my notation here means.
That's right. Okay. Good. Thanks. And the second question is more like this diagram, right? I'm just wondering whether the center portion, right? So suppose I forget about the bottom one. Is there a way to get like M lambda L just from, say, the split property of the algebra?
From what? Sorry, the structure of the algebra?
From the split property. Because if I take one dimensional algebra, right, I can always find a type 1 wedge in between. And now the question is, can I get this free just from the split property or not?
This is a very good question. I agree. You should be able to, maybe. I don't know how to do it.
Okay.
But I think yes. I should just say something, which is that it would still be infinite dimensional, so you would need to like regulate it again. But I do think that it's a promising thing to try to do it through the split property. And now that you're mentioning the split property, I should say that there is one thing that these large N algebras don't know about, which is chaos. So in order to have a dual space-time that is smooth, it's believed that your boundary theory should be maximally chaotic in the large enemy. There's a very nice conjecture by Faulkner, Elny, that tells you that this emergence of a local spacetime is basically the same as having a spacetime that satisfies the split property in the large n limit. And so the conjecture is that the emergence of a net of algebras that satisfies the split property should be equivalent to the saturation of chaos at large n. So yeah, now that you mention it, this is also another reason why the split property could be important in that context. Yeah, that's a good question.
You said something about how the chi lambdas correspond to the background that fixes the high energy part, but mm-hmm. and then different part you said that the high energy part gets thrown out and we're essentially like keeping the low energy part, and that's what we're working with. So is this low energy part background independent, or like why do we throw away this background dependent term?
Okay, so maybe I was a bit confusing in the sense I said throw it away. So the idea is, this large n algebra has so many modes. And what we want to do is some of the modes, if we fix n on the boundary, are going to go crazy. So we want to throw them away. So a way to do it is you take your large n Hilbert space, which is infinite dimensional. You isolate a small part, which is under good control. And you say, OK, that part, I can do whatever I want. And you freeze the rest. You don't make it disappear, but you freeze it. And now what you're saying is that your bulk to boundary map, you restrict it to states that all look the same as this chi lambda and this high energy piece, but then get changed in the low energy piece. So I'm not really throwing it away. All what I mean is that this high energy piece, when I look at my QES formula, doesn't contribute, essentially because I restricted my code to the low energy piece.
So is the formula you end up with, is it background independent?
Well, I guess the thing is you first start with the background, right? Because in order to have this large n algebra, a lot of this discussion is that it completely changes depending which background you're on. Right? So you start with the background, and then you regulate it. So the way to think about these large n algebras is, first I have my formal algebra single traces. Then I impose some kind of reference state for my background, which is essentially going to dictate my background. For example, the thermophile double dictates that you're on a wormhole or not, depending on the temperature. That leaves me with a potentially very divergent algebra, but already on this background, and then I regulate it. OK, so I would say it's still dependent on the background, but the whole point of this is that you should start from something background independent and then specialize to a sector in which you do have a background in the semi-classical limit. We can talk more about it.
Could you explain your statement about the saturation of the chaos bound and having a smooth geometry? Well, there are certainly counterexamples in the sectors where you get the boundary of something the furthest away from being chaotic and involved there. There are smooth geometries.
Okay, so these smooth geometries contribute, right, to whatever. Are you calculating an index or?
No, they're not. Well, they're Lorentzian geometries. It's not known how they.
Well, I think this. So the statement I was making, I'm not sure it contradicts what you're saying, but the statement I was making is that it is believed that in order to get a local bulk dual, like in order, if you're an observer, in order to have a theory that asymptotes to something in which you can talk about an observer that moves on a smooth space-time and so on, you do need saturation of chaos, right? Otherwise, there's going to be some kind of non-locality in your dual string theory.
Well, you could have a geometry which is completely smooth and DPS dual to something very specific.
Right, but can you, like, if you actually calculate, so it's, in what sense is it dual? Like, is it really, like, if I'm an observer, like, can I trust this geometry for calculating every single measurement I'm doing? And is it going to look like?
I love the energy of the trying to calculate, but as long as it's a probe.
I mean, it also depends on, is it for subregions you're talking about, or?
No, I think I'm just talking about modeling smooth space times. temperature, say BPS. So if a comment about maximal chaos was about instead of about like the smoothness of the horizon or something like that, then I can understand. But if it was if the comment was about smoothness of space-time in general, then I'm not sure.
I think you exactly resolved it. Yeah, I think what I meant is really smoothness of horizons.
Okay.
Or including local horizons of render observers.
Yes.